Good to see you all. My wife is traveling. She was up in Illinois this week, so she'll be joining us later, I guess. I have had a number of questions over the years from people, and usually they come in one of three areas, or at least most of them have come in one of three areas. The first area is Greek, because I took Greek, so everybody tends to ask me questions about Greek, so that's what I've been doing most of probably over the years. And then the second area that came as a result of taking Greek was textual criticism, which is kind of the study of the manuscripts involved in the Greek New Testament and what were they originally, or what was the most original of them, and what was most likely to be the original wording. So that's what that's all about. But the third area that I've had the most questions in over the years is probably a discussion about the judgments and about God's laws as he gives them in, some of them are in Exodus and some of them are in Leviticus. And so this afternoon I'd like to take a look at the judgments of God and see their use and their validity for the Christian today. Oftentimes people will ask a question like just what things in the Old Testament or what things in the judgments and the things, the law that was given to Moses, which ones of those are still applicable today for the Christian, which ones are not, which ones have been done away. There are different phrases that people use and questions that they ask. Or if which ones are fading away, as it's phrased in the book of Hebrews. If you turn over there to Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13, it tells us a little bit about what's fading away in terms of the Old Testament and the Old Covenant. Hebrews chapter 8. And let's see, verse 13. Hebrews 8, verse 13. In that he says, a new covenant he has made the first, and it says, I think, obsolete in the New King James. Now, what is becoming obsolete and growing old is getting ready to vanish away. And in other translations, it says, what is fading away rather than being obsolete. It's not really obsolete. That's not the way the Greek reads. It's something that is fading away or disappearing, because obviously the new covenant is in place and people can take part in the new covenant now. First, we have to realize that all of the judgments will ultimately be done away with in the Great White Throne Judgment period after the millennium, after the third resurrection is complete, because there won't be any more human beings. So there will be no need for a codified law, because the law will be part of the way spirit beings live. It will be part of their heart and mind and how they react to it perfectly. That's something that's just going to disappear because there won't be any need for a written law to be written down, because it'll be in our hearts. Spirit beings will know how to express God's love to one another and to God. There'll be no need for it to be written or codified. But there are several things in the Old Covenant that have been, and I'll use a different word, superseded by the New Covenant. And the first of them is its glory, the glory of the Old Covenant. If you turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul discusses a number of things about the Old Covenant in this chapter. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, and let's see, I want to read verses 7 and 8 in this case. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. So then, neither he who plants is any... I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong place. That's 1 Corinthians, isn't it? Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. Wrong chapter and verse. Okay. Let's see. Verse 7 and verse 8. But if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadfastly at the face of Moses because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? How will the new covenant not be more glorious? Another way to say it. That's the first thing that's passing away. The second thing, or the second thing that's being superseded, is the administration of death. Also, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, if you look at verses 6 and 8, who also made us sufficient as ministers of the new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. But if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not look steadfastly or steadily at the face of Moses, because of the glory of his countenance, which glory was passing away. And then in verse 8, how will the ministry of the Spirit not be more glorious? Those verses, I just read them again, but it's good to read them again in the light of the administration of death or the administration of life, which is what the new covenant is. The third area that's passing away or disappearing is the veil on their minds. It has been superseded, not taken away completely as yet. It will be. Most of the world still walks in blindness today. Even though some judgments may not be technically or technically be obligatory anymore for one reason or another, there is likely to be a spiritual lesson that is obligatory on the New Covenant Christian. And we need to look for those when we look at the Old Covenant and we look at the individual judgments that God gave in it. There's a couple of more verses in this chapter that cover the veil, verses 13 and 14. Let's read those. It says, unlike Moses, who put a veil over his face so that the children of Israel could not look steadily at the end of what was passing away, but their minds were blinded. For until this day, the same veil remains, unlifted in the reading of the Old Testament, because the veil was taken away in Christ. Once people turn to Jesus Christ, a change begins to occur. Nevertheless, when one turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. That's part of what we call a calling today in the New Covenant or the New Testament terms. Today, spiritual understanding is given through the power of God's Holy Spirit. And for that, one must be compliant with the requirements of the New Covenant in order for that to occur. Blindness is not removed from everyone as yet, but it certainly will be when Jesus Christ returns and the millennium begins of his reign. Let's look at a fourth area that's superseded. That is the carnal and fleshly ordinances, or the carnal and fleshly ordinances or customs of the Old Testament. These included meat and meal offerings, touchings, washings, oblations, offerings. Those are summarized for us basically in Daniel chapter 9 and verse 27. I won't go there and read it, but it summarizes them briefly for us. The fifth area that's superseded is the need for a physical priesthood. The need for a physical priesthood. In Hebrews chapter 7, if you'll turn over there, Paul once again talks about it. I'm a firm believer that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. You have to realize the entire Eastern Empire of the Roman Empire accepted the fact, or at least all the Christians in it, accepted that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. It was the Western Empire that decided, well, we're not so sure Paul wrote that, because it addresses things that were very Jewish in concept, and they were at that time very upset with anyone who spoke of anything Jewish or anything Jewish in the Bible, so they tended to deal with only the New Testament. But most people knew that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 7. where am I? I'm going to Hebrews chapter 10 in this case. Let's go to Hebrews 10. Did I say Hebrews 7? I'm sorry. Hebrews chapter 10. Let's take a look at Hebrews 10 and verse... I guess I do want to go to Hebrews 7 too, but I'll go to... let's read Hebrews 10 first while I'm here. You're probably not there yet, but Hebrews chapter 10... And let's look at start in verse 10. By that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But this man, and the M in man is capitalized, you'll notice, talking about Christ, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. Now let's go back to Hebrews 7 and verse 11. Hebrews 7 and verse 11. It's not necessary that I have to read these in order, but it's good to read them to understand what's going on with this disappearing physical priesthood of the Levites. Chapter 7. And beginning in verse 11, therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest should rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed, of necessity, there is also a change of the law. Now, if you drop down to verse 18, he continues the same thought again. For on the one hand, there is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness, dealing with the commandment to have a priesthood and to offer sacrifices. This is the commandment of the sacrifices that he's referring to. So that physical priesthood is no longer necessary because of Christ's sacrifice. You can read Hebrews chapter 7 through 10 if you want. It'll cover all of that material quite thoroughly. Paul discusses it all. The sixth area that's superseded in terms of the Old Covenant is the need for circumcision. Genesis chapter 17 verse 10 talks about Abraham being required to be circumcised there. Romans 2:29 in the New Testament, Acts 15 verse 1, and a little bit later on in the chapter, there's a number of verses that discuss the no longer necessary process of circumcision. Why was circumcision so demanded, so needed in the Old Covenant, in the Old Testament? Because it was a symbol of the Old Covenant. If you were going to come under the terms of the Old Covenant, you and all the males in your family had to be circumcised. What's the symbol of the new covenant? Anybody know? What do we have to have in order to receive God's Holy Spirit? Well, we have to have hands laid on us. What happens before the hands get laid on us? Baptism. Baptism is the symbol of the new covenant. If you want to be in the new covenant, that's why we take baptism so seriously. Because if you want to take part in the new covenant, you have to be baptized. That's why it's there. Okay, that's why circumcision is no longer required, because we have a new symbol we live by under the new covenant. Number seven, the seventh area here that I've got listed, and there may be others, but this is the way I've summarized them into seven pieces, is the civil laws of our country and our states and our cities sometimes have superseded our own physical government, as our physical governments today have superseded the need for the laws that were given to Israel for it and to be its own government. So those are now gone. Those are now superseded by our governments today. This includes things that are no longer required to do because our civil governments have assumed the responsibility for them. Quarantine is one of the things that the government is responsible to take care of. That's one that we have experienced recently. Also, retribution for murder, rape, robbery, things like that. Those things have been taken by our government as civil authority to punish for those things. These are actions and crimes that the government attributes punishments for, or has the authority to put into action. These are the primary things that are no longer in force, or which we now are now being superseded by our governments today. Not that they were not good, but as we go through the individual judgments, we'll see which ones of the judgments are really no longer in full force and effect as they were in the past. Most of the judgments are found listed in two places in the Old Testament. Exodus chapter 21 to 23 is where most of them are, and Leviticus 18 through 22. Those chapters contain most of the judgments that God gave to Moses to give to Israel. I want to turn over to Leviticus 18 now and begin to look at some of those. Leviticus 18. And I want to read the first few verses of the chapter because God introduces these to Moses and what they're for. And the Lord spoke unto Moses in Leviticus 18, verse 1, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say to them, I am the Lord your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt," very interesting expression, "after the doings of the land of Egypt," in other words, the things that you learned there or that you saw there or that you witnessed there, "after the doings of the land of Egypt wherein you dwelt, shall you not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I will bring you to, shall you not do. Neither shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall do my judgments and keep my my ordinances to walk therein. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord your God." Very strict instructions that we are to obey them. And in other places, it also says they are forever, or to be kept forever. So now we have to look at the judgments and say, okay, they're to be kept forever. Something to think about as we read through the judgments, as we come to understand them. Realize, too, that one day you and I may be called upon to judge other people during the millennium. When we become spirit beings, we may judge others. We may even be called upon to judge angels at one point in time. How can you judge if you don't know them, if you're not familiar with them? I think we all need to be familiar with them, at least for the most part. We should be familiar with them and why. Clearly, we're being encouraged to know them so that we can live in them. And the Pharisees, of course, in Christ's day, prevented people from understanding and knowing the judgments. God said to Moses that he was to tell Israel that they were to live by the judgments, not Moses' judgments, not the Pharisees' judgments, not the scribes' judgments, not anyone else's judgments. You get my point. They are God's judgments. Verses 6 through 18 now of this chapter deal with the subject of slavery and incest and some family relations here as well. God gives instructions to Moses for him to give to Israel concerning sex and marriage within families, and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. And these laws are applicable to us today. They are supplemented in some cases, but not superseded by our government's civil laws regarding marriage and incest. Of course, the civil laws of the U.S. are in many cases based upon these very judgments. For example, slavery is not allowed in any form in any of our states or in our country or in our legal system, but there aren't many of the judgments that are left that our federal governments or our state governments still really enforce or uphold. Most of our state laws say that a brother may not marry a sister, and so on. In some cases, the offense becomes a criminal penalty, such as the case where parents are in the process of abusing their children. So these laws are not only moral, but they are also civil codes as well. And this means that technically they have been supplemented by the civil laws of our cities, states, and our federal government, when and where our government at least has a civil code regarding them. If our government says nothing about a particular issue, then we need to examine what the scriptural judgments actually determine or say, whether the scriptures overrule our government's civil laws. If our government's laws overrule the principles in the Bible or do not establish justice or conformity to scripture, then God's word overrules them. Sometimes the church must actually step in and examine what stance we will take as a people and as a church, and what members should do. How the church deals with some of those things is something that has been taken up periodically in the past. The issue of third tithe, that's one of the things that has been taken up and considered by the council and others as to what we do in regard to third tithe. The third tithe comes 2 years out of seven, the third and sixth year of a seventh year. So in effect, it's not really a full 10% if you consider the 7 years as a whole. It's more like 28.5% over 7 years. Our leadership has examined the taxes that we pay in regard to that amount and what the taxes are for. The taxes we pay, much of them is supposed to go for the poor and the needy, which is what the function of the third tithe is. And so you are free to pay third tithe if you wish to do so, but the church has said that it's not necessary to do so because we now pay a third tithe in effect or more in terms of the taxes we pay to the government, which is supposed to be used for the poor and the needy in our society. It may or may not be effectively used that way, but that's what they say it's used for. Let's take another example here. It's very important to think about the spiritual principle behind these things, not just the physical judgment itself. Before we say something is no longer applicable under today's civil system, consider the spiritual implications behind it for a Christian today. Leviticus 18 and verse 18 is something I want to discuss briefly. Chapter 18 and verse 18. This point in time in Israel, men were permitted to have more than one wife. And that's what this verse is really all about. Through Moses, God is saying here that a man was not to take two sisters to wife during the life of both of them. If a man's wife died and then he chose to marry her sister after her death, that would be permitted. But that's kind of the concept behind this verse. But it was classified under the heading of incest to marry both at the same time. Now you're probably asking, well, how does that apply to me today? Or what's the applicable about that to us today? It's the spiritual principle behind it that's applicable today. First, let's examine the physical and the emotional implications here. Not marrying two sisters simultaneously is not just for the sake of the sisters. It is for the sake of the sister's family and the entire family. Physically speaking, daughters and sons often inherited land next to each other. So families would live in close proximity to each other. And emotionally speaking, when a woman marries, she becomes solely dedicated to her husband, and vice versa, a woman to her husband to her wife. But sisterhood is also a very close emotional relationship too, because sisters share almost everything. For emotional reasons, they should not have to share a husband. What would happen if a dispute developed between the two sisters later, after they were married to one man? Let's say a dispute over the land owned by one of them. And the adjacent land owned by the other before the marriage. whichever claim is made is found to be right, the husband is going to then alienate the other wife. If he favors one, he dishonors the other. If he favors one and dishonors the other, you see the problem here developing. When you think about the physical and the emotional entanglements involved, it's a nightmare. It's a no-win situation for the husband and for the wives. And that's why God says, don't do it. That's the physical side of it. What about the spiritual side? The spiritual intent of this command, as well as most of the other judgments, is to teach us how to love our neighbor. Marrying two sisters is not, in effect, is not loving our neighbor. That's the spiritual law. That's the New Testament, the New Covenant part of this. In fact, loving our neighbor is the spiritual principle behind many of the judgments. That's what they're for, to teach us how to love our neighbor. Judgments about the treatment of family, neighbors, even animals, all represent this principle. So even though some of the judgments may not technically be obligatory anymore, or we may not have to worry about them because we don't marry more than one wife, or things like that today, or for one reason or another, there is likely to be a spiritual reason behind them that is obligatory to the Christian today. And that principle is what we should be looking for and learning, and also beginning to understand how to put into practice should we have to judge in the future others. Many of the Old Testament judgments are civil rulings, and civil judgments are generally supplemented, overruled, or superseded by the fact that we have civil governments over us today, which neither we nor the church are able to control. We hope and pray that our governments will choose justice by the laws that they put into effect, but we do not control them. In most cases, man's laws do not go as far as God's law, or as strictly as God's law does. For example, most governments are very liberal in allowing divorce and remarriage, aren't they? But the Bible and God's law are not so liberal regarding marriage. In Leviticus 18, verse 19, we find another one here. Let's take a look at chapter 18, verse 19. This is talking about, it's a different example, relating to a woman's monthly period or a menstruation period. This one relates to health, and it's something human beings would normally not know and would not understand unless God revealed it to us. In a way, it could be classified as a statute rather than a judgment. A husband is not to have sexual relations with his wife during her time of the month or her menstruation period. Why, we might ask, and some people do immediately ask why. Doesn't seem to do any harm. Well, that's very human reasoning, isn't it? Some might say human reasoning. God knows why he gave us these judgments. We often don't know the why of how God gave them to us. He tells us what to do and how to do it, but he doesn't say why to do it, very often at least, that I've found in the scriptures. I'd like to read you something, though. Let me tell you about a comment that was found in the Journal of Reproductive Medicine, Volume 54 of November 1989. The article indicates that there is a health risk for women who have sex during their menstrual period. There is a very high risk for developing cysts on the ovaries and other pelvic organs during this time, which is a common cause of infertility. Now, that's one physical reason. How long did it take us to come up with that reason? From the time Moses gave the law until 1989, before people really understood that there can be a problem there, that there really is a physical reason for the law. But there are probably other reasons for the law as well. I'm not just narrowing it down to one. I'm just saying, you know, there are various reasons for this. And I'm sure God has many reasons for doing so or giving us these types of judgments. In light of that information, how long does it take us to come up with a reason? A long time. What if there are other judgments that come into question that we may look at and say, how does that really apply today, and why is that something we should or shouldn't do today? Well, we may find in the future that there are other statements, medically or otherwise, that may explain some of the reasons that God gave for why he instituted these things. And yet, that might only be one reason for this one. Sometimes as human beings, we want to do it my way, and my way until I see that it's not, the results are not good. But that's, you know, pretty much the theme of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, isn't it? Doing things my way. And that's typical human thinking. But God's laws are designed to save us pain and suffering, to keep us like a fence from falling into a rushing stream. And they're meant to introduce us to a life of love and giving to others. That's what they're for. Remember that the primary reason for the law as a whole was introduced to Israel was to teach them how to love one another and how to love God as well. The judgments are an expansion of how to do this, and the Beatitudes in the New Testament are designed to expand the law in a spiritual way in the New Testament. This is another example. Let's take a look at another example here in Leviticus chapter 19. Chapter 19. We're going to stay over here in Leviticus for a little while. Leviticus 19 and verse 13. It says, "You shall not defraud your neighbor, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with you all night until the morning." Why does God say that? Well, God puts holding back wages until the morning after you've done a day's work on a level with robbery here. And I can see at least two principles involved in this physically, plus the spiritual principle of loving your neighbor as well. But first, many laborers were poor, and often they needed the money that they earned during that day's labor in order to buy food for that evening meal to restore their strength before they went back to work the following day. For an employer to keep back the money even the next day was cruel and unjust, and that's why God says not to do it. Secondly, the principle of employers keeping money back over time, over some set period of time, we all know that that occurs today. We all know also that money earns money. If you have money, you can earn money and interest on it in various ways by investing it. Employers should not get in the habit of holding back money even to set pay periods. It does create more work for an employer to pay all of his employees at the end of every day, but then those employees have the money in hand and they can invest it right away for their own benefit rather than the company holding the money and investing it themselves. Employers and employees should be the ones earning, or the employees should be the ones earning the money, not the employer, because they're the ones who earned it. One way to avoid that issue is simply to, when hiring new employees, you pay them a week in advance. Then during their second week of, or during their first week of work, they're beginning to pay for the second week. But it also promotes good relations between employee, employer, and employer in doing so. But this, again, is a civil issue. We have no control over companies and what they do today in terms of that and in terms of the accounting practices of this nation in which we live. But this judgment comes as a civil matter, and Christians can't change those things. But I suspect during the millennium of Christ's rule, there's going to come a change in terms of how those things are done. Let's go to Leviticus 19, verse 17. Look at another one. Leviticus 19:17. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall not in any wise rebuke your neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Now, it's rather difficult in the King James English here to understand what's going on fully or what he's talking about. The wording is a little tough to follow. But the concept is that we are to hate the sin of our neighbor, but not to hate our neighbor. And we are to help him see his sin. Now, that may not come until you get to know your neighbor a little bit better before you're able to be of help, helping him to see his sin. If you're close to someone, you can sometimes help them see the sin that is hurting them and their family or their friends or whatever, while still maintaining your relationship. But if we do it cold turkey with somebody we don't know, it's very hard to be diplomatic with somebody you don't know. And it doesn't get done very well. That's part of learning to love your neighbor first. Verse 19 is another one. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind. You shall not sow your field with mingled seed. Neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon you. Now, this verse has presented people with all kinds of difficulty over the years in a number of ways. Many have misconstrued it to be discussing or to be an issue against interracial marriage, but it has nothing to do with that. Remember, the context of the chapter here actually started in chapter 18, verse 3, the doings of the land of Egypt. Remember, I told you to look at that phrase. God said, don't do what you learned in Egypt. Do things the way I'm teaching them to you. Don't let your cattle mix with diverse kinds like the Egyptians did. The Egyptians were very good at mixing up worship and compromise and mixtures, and the Egyptians were very good at those kinds of things, especially religiously. They were good at mixing gods and goddesses and mixing animals of different kinds in the process of worshiping them. Even their gods were part eagle and part man, or part crocodile and part man. And today, many religions are a mixture of paganism and Christianity as well. The context of chapter 18 and 19 actually concerns spiritual morality. It is the book of Leviticus, after all, that we're reading here. And Leviticus, if you had to put Leviticus into one word to summarize what it's all about, you could take the word purity and describe Leviticus. That's what it's really about. The Levites were a type of Christians today. They were held to stricter standards than most of Israel was held to. The summary injunction to this chapter 18 is found in verse 3 and verse 4, particularly in verse 4 in chapter 18. And it's, and I'll quote it again, after the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwelt, shall you not do, and after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall you not do. Neither shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall do my judgments and keep mine ordinances to walk therein. I am the Lord your God. They were not to do as the Egyptians did. And the Egyptians were involved in various pagan fertility rites and perversions, such as men with beasts. God wanted Israel to be a pure people, unpolluted by pagan influence, and the Egyptians were known for unnatural unions of all kinds, animals with animals of different kinds, and even mixing seed to create strange plants and food. All were a part of a system of idolatrous worship of pagan deities. And this verse is therefore a request to Israel to be pure in its unions, whether they be human, animal, seed, or clothing. Notice verse 19 again, this last sentence in verse 19. Neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon you. Why? Well, we can ask why. God says not to do it. Many people have made fun of New Covenant Christians and said, well, why are you doing all of these Old Covenant judgments and mixing threads and fabrics and calling us legalistic because we do so? But perhaps we ought to consider that God doesn't say or inspire things to be written lightly or for no reason. He has a reason for the things that he says and does. It's easy to poke fun at the concept of only being able to wear a cotton shirt and not a cotton shirt mixed with other fabric. But before we laugh too loudly, we have to examine the spiritual principle behind it, behind the words and what inspired them to be written, especially the last sentence of verse 19. Neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon you. Why? God says not to. That's the first reason, so we don't do it. But also because there is more to it than the idea of mixed fabrics associated with worship of gods and of wood and stone and things that the Egyptians did. Today, that's not necessarily the case. But physically, cotton and linen or wool don't go together well in the same fabric. I bought a shirt many years ago when we were in Alaska for the feast, brought it home. It had a lining inside of it. It was a heavy winter cotton shirt, and it had a lining inside that was synthetic, and it had filling in it to keep it warm during the winter. It was actually an inferior garment because those things don't all shrink at the same rate. You put them in the washer, and you find out why very quickly. Problems and begin to develop with something that's made that way right away. Not surprisingly, the shirt fell apart after a few washings. A mixed garment usually doesn't wear well because the material and the lining and the cotton and the wool and other things do not shrink at the same rate. So the shirt was warm, yes, but I wouldn't buy it again. Now, why wouldn't I buy it again? Well, because I felt like I was taken. It was very pure, poor quality in terms of it being put together. The synthetic lining, yes, it held in the filling for the warmth, but it didn't function very well. When you realize that ancient Israel was a barter system of how they, you know, they didn't exchange money for things, they bartered, they traded things. So you had some people in Israel that made clothing, you had some people that made other products that people wanted, then they would trade for the things they needed from the things that they made and gave away to others or gave to others in trade. So what happens when you trade off inferior garments to other Christians, to other members of Israel? Well, you're taking advantage of your brother, aren't you? And that's not something that loving your neighbor we are to do. God doesn't condone our making cheap and poor quality garments to sell to somebody else or to trade and barter with other people. Remember why the judgments were given again. Are we loving our neighbor to do that? Obviously not. Don't cheat your neighbor by making and selling junk to him, in other words. So what we have here is a consumer protection law, really, in that statement. First, God doesn't want people making cheap goods and giving them away. But it's a consumer protection law. Okay, Israel was God's special people. He doesn't want us to mix up the worship of inferior systems, pagan systems, or whatever, with God's way of worship, and not to do the things that we're told not to do, that we learned in Egypt, or we may have taken from Egypt. Mixtures are one of the many major dangers lurking for church members today as well. Our society is full of them. Satan loves mixtures. What do you think the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is? It's a mixture. That's why God says not to take of it and take part in it. Clearly, there is a very powerful overall lesson here being conveyed in the book of Leviticus. It's the book of the Levitical priesthood. They were to keep themselves pure, unmixed from all other forms. They were not to touch, not to contact things that would make them unclean and prevent them from being functioning in the ministry or in their priesthood. Let me give you something to ponder, something I've run into before we close. I've mentioned one judgment in passing in the past. Let's go to Leviticus 19, verse 23. Leviticus 19, 23. And when you shall come into the land and shall have planted all manner of trees for food, then you shall count the fruit thereof as uncircumcised. 3 years shall it be as uncircumcised unto you. It shall not be eaten of. There may be some ceremonial reason that God gave this. I don't know why in particular this particular judgment was given, but I'm curious why God did give it. If anyone happens to know why, I'd love to hear. Maybe there's something to do, and I can speculate here about a couple of possibilities. Maybe there was something about a new tree and the root passing various things from the soil directly into the fruit during the first 3 years. And after 3 years, maybe the tree grows some type of filtration system, like the human liver or something, that prevents some of that from going directly into the fruit. I don't know. Maybe God knew that today's strong chemical fertilizers and other things were not going to be real or processed adequately by a new tree until it was 3 years old before it became something that we could eat. I don't know. There's a lot of things you could speculate as to why God gave that particular judgment. The same is true for some of the judgments, and I don't have time to cover them all. Even in one sermon, I could probably cover a good number in two sermons, but certainly not all of them even two. I don't know why God said to do it. Maybe in the year 2022, we'll read an article in the Journal of Fruit Farmers explaining why it's not good to eat fruit off of new trees for the first 3 years. I don't know. Maybe something like that will come along. Of course, I'm being a little humorous here, but you know, there are reasons why God gave us these judgments. And we have to learn how to implement them, not only in our own lives, but we also have to learn how to implement them and how to judge others for implementing them in the future, or if we're not implementing them. This sermon and the one that I have put together following it, if I get a chance to give a second one, I'll cover some of the things in Exodus which are of interest as well in the second one. Stay tuned. I hope that getting into some of the Old Testament judgments today has been something of help and a benefit to you as in terms of learning to live by the judgments, because they really are not just for ancient Israel. They are for us today, too, as Christians. We need to understand them, the meaning of them, the application of them, so that we can live by them, but also so that we can teach others to live by them, too. Next time, we'll take a look at some of the more difficult judgments as well, and maybe we'll get to some questions that I've put together to help us understand which judgments are still applicable and why they're still applicable in the future.